The date today is the 6th of September, and I'm sitting in my kitchen with Chris Duffield. She's coming with a story that's different from the rest of ours. Chris and her family. You were christened at the church on Lippincott and College. What I'd like you to, which means we're talking from right from the first day of your life. Okay, so what I'd like you to do is tell us the name of the church, the location of the church, and some of your story with the church, going back to day one for you in 1956.
Okay, so it's St. George's Church. It's on 410 College, which is at the corner of College and Lippincott. Now, did you want me to go back to the origins of the church before it moved?
Please do.
Because it's kind of an interesting story.
Definitely.
Anyways, a minister came over from Germany. A lot of people, obviously, it was that whole post-war immigration into Canada. A lot of people came to Canada. And one minister came and he wanted to set up a German congregation, which he did in 1954. And they started by renting other churches, one of them being St. George's Church on John Street. So my parents had a rooming house across the street from that St. George's United Church. And my mom came home from work one day and heard German singing, which kind of surprised her. So she went to investigate and found out there was a German congregation. So that's how they joined that church. And that United Church was very, very good to them. I mean, many of them were immigrants. They needed a lot of help. But unfortunately, there was a fire at that church. And because of that, they had to relocate. And so I think they rented St. Stephen's for a while, but they decided they really didn't want to rent. They were at a point where they wanted to buy. And because the people at St. George's United had been so good, when they bought the church, they also named it St. George's. Now, what was really interesting is, I mean, they didn't have a lot of money. They had saved up so much. And there were a lot of people that, in addition to sort of fundraising, there were a lot of people that actually put up their personal cash in the hopes that they would get paid back at some point in time. So it was a real community effort, and it wasn't just a church, and it still isn't a church. It's really like a German community center. They had some of the first German schools in Toronto there. They used to bring over, like in the 50s when you had a much larger German population, I believe they had poets coming over. They had like musical groups. They had theater groups. Just a lot of activities went on at that church. The other thing, I guess, that the church did, and many generations, well, I think numerous weddings in the earliest years, there are some stats in this, which is kind of interesting. And then for Germans, or Lutherans, confirmation is important. It's like a bat mitzvah. It's like a coming of age.
Uh-huh. So at what age?
Typically around 14.
Uh-huh. Oh, it's similar. You're right.
So it's not like the Catholics. We really don't do the Holy Communion thing. But, you know, for your confirmation, even back in Germany, you were given gifts. It was almost like a dowry, but you were considered an adult at that point in time. So you have really generations of, you know, German Canadians that have been confirmed at that church. So for many people, I know a lot of people, I think, went to the church not only for the religious part, but they would, you know, meet a lot of people who were in similar circumstances. They helped each other get jobs. And it was a place where they were just all, you know, very, very comfortable. You know, one of the challenges over the years is many of them lived in the area. Mm-hmm. I mean, we lived on John Street, so still walking distance to the church. But then people move out, and that demographic ages. So right now, it's really a struggle for the church in the sense that, you know, you have fewer and fewer people going, and obviously it's expensive to run. In my case, I guess I was part of the demographic that, you know, we moved out of the city over to Scarborough. And the reason that we moved was I don't know if you remember back in the 60s, I mean, the developers really controlled the city. And there was the whole block of houses sort of on John, Stephanie, Beverly, and then what's the street on the north side, just before the Grange Park. You know the one I mean, anyways.
Yeah, right. I
anyways, what happened was the developers wanted to buy that block of land to put an apartment building. And at that time, if you didn't sell out to the developers, the city could expropriate your land at less than market value because they had to pay you, I think it was $1,000 per running foot of frontage. Well, those houses didn't have a lot of frontage. So, you know, many of people there, I mean, that was everything that they had. I mean, these are not wealthy people, and you were scared that if you didn't sell out, you know, what would happen to you is what happened in Jamestown, where St. Jamestown, where there's that one house standing.
Yes.
And you'd have big apartment buildings around you. So many people were really sort of forced out of that community. And because of that, my parents then moved out to Scarborough.
So how old were you at that time?
I was going into grade four, so about 8 or 9 years old. And what's very interesting about that, though, is that whole street, I mean, nobody had family, so everybody had to look after each other. So my best friend today is still from John Street. And many of us have kept in touch. And you're talking, how many years later? Like over 40, yeah. 45 years later. And the ones that are still alive still keep in touch.
So you became like family, like good family, like chosen family.
Well, I mean, I can tell you some stories that are really interesting because you know, we had a semi-detached house, and my mother's best friend was the lady that lived next door. And when she gave birth to her third child, you know, she was very, very ill, and they had to perform a hysterectomy right away. So, because at those days you didn't have public health insurance, so literally her husband brought home this newborn, and my mother looked after him, you know, until she was better. It was those, just the way things were done. Or if Stefan would come home, he was a bartender and saw my parents were working and the house, the lights were on, he'd come at 2 in the morning and then help them wallpaper. So it was a very, very strong sense of community.
And that community, you lived in the neighborhood around John Street,
mm-hmm.
and you all went to the same church.
No, actually, we went to different churches. Uh-huh. So a lot of the people there were more Ukrainian than, they spoke German, but they were more Ukrainian, so they would have gone to the churches on Bathurst. There was one just south of college.
Yes.
My father would sometimes go to Trinity Bellwoods. He would go to that one. And because my dad was Ukrainian, my mom was German, my mother wanted, she negotiated that I would be raised as a Lutheran, but I kind of went to whoever had the best party or whatever. You know, it was very flexible. We celebrated 2 Christmases, 2 Easters, that kind of thing.
So you had the best of
absolutely, yeah. But I was more affiliated with the St. George's Church because I was confirmed there. I went to Sunday school there. Often in those days, my parents never had a car. So we would go to church, and then some friends there would have a car, so then we'd go after church, like for a drive in the countryside, or I have pictures, like we went to Riverdale Zoo.
Now, so you described that it was a church, and it was a community center, and it was a very supportive place for a lot of new immigrants,
mm-hmm.
who were looking for jobs, who didn't necessarily have a lot of extended family. So that was 1956, 58, you left around 1964.
Mm-hmm. Now, we still went to that church, like with my mother when I was younger. We would still come down
from
by TTC, you know. But then, I guess I stopped going probably before my mom, but then, you know, my mother, my father got quite ill, my mother got ill, and then it just becomes, you know, a major, major problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's far enough if you're traveling by car and you were traveling by TTC.
Yeah, exactly.
So that made it, it felt even farther because it would be such a long trip. Okay, so 1956 you were born. That's the church your family went to. And this is 2012. What's your situation in terms of church?
Well, what happened was, I didn't go to church, for years. And then my mother died, I think it was 2008, I just lose track of time. And it was important to me that she, her funeral service be bilingual, with a German component, because I knew that that was very, very important to her. And so I contacted the minister, and she gave me a bit of a hard time. Well, you haven't come to the church, but she said, why don't you come to my house and let's talk? So I did, and we really hit it off. And so she did the service, and then I stopped going, and they have something called Toten Sonntag. So it's a day that you remember all the dead people. Mm-hmm. So there was a service, and she invited me back for that, and I took my daughter, and my daughter felt very welcome there. She said it.
So this is 2008, and your daughter was how old at that time?
She was born in 1993, so she would have been, what, about 15, something like that. And then she also decided that she wanted to be confirmed, which was very, very interesting. And the minister there is, she's not one to push religion on people. She would only do it if Catherine genuinely wanted to do it. She didn't want her to do it because I wanted her to do it or anything like that. It had to really be of her own free will. So my daughter went through that whole process as well.
Wow.
And for her, it sounds odd, but it's been a tremendous experience for her. The minister, for Lutherans, they can get married. She has three children of her own. So she's very understanding of children, and even some of the kids on the confirmation class, more like a social worker, if you want to consider it maybe that way, because I know there was one boy, his father had been killed in a car accident, and he really didn't want to go, and he had like attitude just oozing out of him. But she just kind of ignored it and worked with him and sort of brought him along. In my daughter's case, she has Asperger's. Mm-hmm. And so the minister would get her to speak at things at church. It really built up her confidence. And then also, I think, because one of the reasons why I moved to Scarborough was because my parents actually looked after my children.
While you went to work.
While I went to work. I'm a single parent, so it was, it really worked out well. So she felt that Omi means grandmother in German. Mm-hmm. So she felt when she was there, she was surrounded by a whole bunch of Omis, as she used to say it, because she really missed. My kids were very, very close to their grandparents.
So you went to work, and your parents, your mother in particular, raised your children.
Yeah, my father was pretty active in it as well. Mm-hmm. So going there, it sort of, I guess, gave her a sense of that connection to the culture maybe that she had grown up with, just hearing German, even though she doesn't understand it very well. She just felt at home there.
What a lovely story. What a lovely story that your daughter felt connected and comfortable mm-hmm. in that place. And that was 2008.
Right.
So what's happening now between 2008 and 2012?
Well,
with your daughter and you and the church.
So actually I've gotten more involved. I mean, obviously they have a lot of financial challenges, so they asked me to be on their council, which is effectively their board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've gotten involved, that way. I also feel very comfortable there. I mean, for me, the big thing is Christmas Eve. Germans, Christmas Day isn't as big a deal as Christmas Eve. So going there, the services haven't changed. From when you were very, very little.
Oh, lovely.
Which is kind of interesting. And, sometimes it's really nice. I mean, I'm all pro-change. I don't resist change. But sometimes it's nice to have a bit of a connection with the past and to have those traditions.
Yeah. And it's very familiar, therefore comfortable.
Absolutely. Yeah. I always thought, because a lot of people walk by the church and really don't know what's in there, I came up with the idea of getting involved in Doors Open. And part of it, too, for me, would force me to research the church a little bit more and understand its social history, because that's just something that I happen to be interested in. So actually, my daughter did a lot of the research as well. And that's basically how we got involved in Doors Open. We learned a lot. We put together this PowerPoint presentation, and it also helped us meet a lot of people in the community. I think what's really interesting about the church is, you know, so in the 1956, it sort of started helping German Canadians, and really the minister that we have today really spends a lot of her time as a social worker, in the sense of visiting, you know, a lot of people who are elderly, alone, and I think immigrants are really vulnerable to that because, you know, they don't have any family. A lot of them were single, never married, and there's really nobody, you know, to help them.
What's the composition of the population there now? Ages, and is it still mainly people who were originally from Germany, or parents or grandparents from Germany? Who's there now?
So what she's tried to do is start a English congregation as well. It's very small, so you've got a real mix. So you've got a few people that were there from like day one.
Wow.
So you've got a number of Germans, and they don't like anything change, you know, and they want everything in German. They're not even so fussy about this bilingual thing. Then you would have some people like myself whose parents died or whatever, and through that made a connection back. Or people who want their children to be confirmed or want that connection, I guess, with maybe German culture. I mean, Germans assimilated pretty well into Canada, but still it's nice to have some kind of connection. And then we also have, not a lot, but a number of students from U of T who are here from Germany, and that's kind of their connection as well. And sometimes we have one individual is Buddhist, but his father was a Lutheran minister and his mother spoke German. And, you know, so he comes usually every Sunday, and he grew up in the area. So it's a real diverse group.
It is. And there are services every Sunday.
Right. Typically there's two, one English and one in German, except one Sunday, I think it's the second Sunday of the month, they have a bilingual.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And then it's the way that the services work there is after each one, everyone meets downstairs for coffee and cake and socializes. And for a lot of the elderly women, it's like the highlight of their week. There's a German, you know, group, and they're able to do less and less. But like some of them are so ill, yet they find a way to come because I think it's probably their social outing of the week.
Well, and I'm going to come back to this. Are there still other activities happening there? Like, there were so many things happening in 1956 and 1960. It was a community center in addition. Do they have additional programs right now?
Less and less. I mean, there's still a Sunday school there. There's a confirmation class. There's a ladies group. They do things, for example, for just before Christmas, they still do like a Christmas play, but it's they don't have the numbers to support the activities that they used to have. But they're still, it's a fairly musical congregation.
Ah.
So the minister's daughter is a graduate of Western, and her husband actually builds organs, and he rebuilt that whole organ there in that church. And some of the church members, their daughters are in, what is it, the Toronto Children's Choir? So there's a lot of musical things happening there, but they try and integrate it into the services, or they'll have concerts maybe two times a year. But it isn't clearly not on the same scale. I mean, you just don't have the same kind of numbers of people.
And when people are in church, it sounds as if a lot of people are singing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And are some of them harmonizing?
Oh, yeah. Well, the ones that can.
Right.
Are, so
you have beautiful music.
Yeah, it's important to everyone. I mean, it was interesting. We had a wedding shower there, I guess, two Sundays ago. And so someone, you know, Germans love to sing. And I'd never heard this before. So she said, do you mind if we sing like a German sort of wedding song? And I'm there, okay, like, okay, whatever. What makes you happy, you know? And I was surprised. Like, obviously it was well known because you had all these German women singing these songs that I had never heard of before. I mean, I think Europeans, when it comes to weddings, they have more of a program, a lot of poetry and singing and as part of their thing. So that was kind of interesting for me.
And does your daughter go to church most Sundays now?
We try. I like what I like about this minister. I mean, life is busy for everybody, so she's not one like you have to be there every Sunday. Her thing is like, come when you can. So we try every second week, you know, but you don't sweat it if you can't.
Yeah, so she doesn't kind of give you a look or make you feel guilty? And
I think that would probably drive people away.
I agree with you, yeah. Now, you say they have a group for women. Is this elderly women?
Yeah, they're primarily elder. The minister would go and but they're primarily older women. Mm-hmm. And they're responsible. They take care of making sure that there's coffee and tea and the baking for, you know, after the Sunday services. The other thing that the minister does, which I think is nice, is she tries to reach out to different groups. So I know she's been involved with Kosky. You know, they have the building on the Pincott. Mm-hmm. And she's been in touch with them and invites not only people, but sometimes like we'll have garage sales and things, and she'll say, you know, for things that haven't been taken up or people have done it, just tell the people to come and take whatever it is that they want. She also, because there's a number of Germans in old age homes. There's, I think, Molly Bertsey, and there's one up at the Don O'Schwaben Club. It's at McCowan and Ellesmere. So she will go there and have services there and bring, like, potluck. Because for a lot of people, it's getting more and more difficult, you know, to come downtown.
And you said after each service, there's people cake. Gather and have cake. And the members bring the cake? Or is it bought and does somebody set it up? How does all that work?
The women's group kind of takes care of it. Uh-huh. And most of it's donations, and then they just kind of freeze it to make it easy, right?
And how long do people usually hang around?
Depends on the week how busy people are, but at least I would say half an hour or so. And you've got I'm quite impressed. You have a real core group of people that are very, very dedicated and, you know, give a lot of their time. In many cases, probably because they know it's so important to, like, their mothers. Like, this one guy drives his mother, who must be 86, 87, you know, down every week. Again, they don't live downtown anymore, but that's an important part of their life.
It sounds quite lovely. I mean, I think when we're talking about the music, the beautiful music, and people singing, mm-hmm. and then having this gathering after, it is... As somebody who's a social worker, which I am, I think that is vital, the sense of community, mm-hmm. and belonging and anticipation. As you say, for some of these elderly women, it's probably the highlight of their week.
Yeah, for me, like I connected with some people, and you know, when you have a cultural connection, like you grew up sort of the same way with the same values. You know, it turns out like Andrea, she's actually a pharmacist at St. Mike's.
Andrea
now
is
she's a member of the church, and her and her husband made a conscious decision that they wanted their daughters brought up sort of more in the German tradition. Her parents went to that church, she went there, she was married there, and you know, so she's become, you know, we just click, mm-hmm. you know, and I think a lot of it is because you've grown up with sort of the same sort of background, values, that kind of thing.
Are your other children interested at all? Do they?
No, they will do it as a favor to me,
yeah.
which is fine. Yeah. And I've never been one to force the issue. I mean, it works for me in the sense that my older son has lived around this area. He's a musician and works at U of T as well. Now he's had to move out a little bit further because the rents are, right now he's around Dufferin and DuPont. But so often, like, we'll go to church, and then afterwards we'll meet for brunch. And so it's a way of keeping in touch. It's just kind of work it into the, you know, the day's activities.
Can you you've described a little bit about some of the changes because people have moved away and you have an older population. Just in terms of changes, what else comes to your mind about what has happened between 1956, which is a very long time ago? What are some of the changes of not only of the population, but the physical structure of the building?
Physical structure really has not changed much. I mean, what's fascinating is when I did research on the church, and it was a James Robertson, he wrote the book Landmarks of Toronto. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, but and I brought some of the stuff. He was, I think, the first publisher of the Toronto Telegram, and he visited so many places in the city and wrote very descriptive accounts of them, and it really provided a really good overview of sort of the social history of Toronto. Well, he actually visited the church back then, and he had someone do even like a sketch of the inside. And what's remarkable is it really hasn't changed, you know, in all of those years. I mean, the other thing is they've kept it very neat, very clean, but there's not a lot of money. I think from the time that they took over the church, and obviously I would have been too young to remember, like, they built a stage downstairs because they had, like, a theater group. And they used to perform, you know, the Christmas plays and all of that there. And also they wanted a church bell. So someone knew somebody that donated one from Germany. And then they actually, like, built the steeple, which I thought was kind of interesting. I mean, they've always done things at minimal cost. Anyone who was able to help did.
And that's another way of people participating and feeling more invested. The more you put into something, the more you get out of it.
I mean, even recently we had some water damage in part of the ceiling, and again, there's not tons of money to make the repairs, but a number of people came together. We had one guy, it was a young, he just graduated from an engineering degree in Germany, and did a sort of I guess you can come to Canada and work for, there's permits you can get, I guess, as a young student, basically, to work in Canada. He wanted to do like a work travel type program. So in Germany, people tend to go to church a little bit more than here. So he was looking for a German church. He came, but he had worked as like a carpenter before. So he kind of, you know, helped us fix everything, you know, and like a lot of the men that used to help with the church, I mean, they're in their 70s, 80s. You do not want them climbing up on ladders. But between all of them, you know, they made it work, and I think we repaired all the damage for about like $700 or something like that, which was pretty amazing.
Yeah. So it's not people kind of from the outside just giving a couple of bucks. They roll up their sleeves and they participate in everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, including when you talked about baking.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so people are really participating because it's our church and our community.
Well, so many of them don't want to lose it. And they know that financially things are very touch and go. But that's just, I guess, one of the challenges, you know.
But they've obviously taken good care of the building.
Yeah, they've done, you know, they haven't done anything like fancy, but they've kept it.
It has its original beauty, its original structure and its original beauty.
Yeah, it's quite nice inside. But it's interesting when you read Robertson's account, you know, he talks about the way it looked way back when in the 1870s, saying, you know, it's not a very nice church from the outside, but when you go in, it's got a nice ambience. I mean, it's not a wealthy church. And it's a good size, and I mean, I can, you know, just show you some of the pictures. It's actually, I found it remarkable, the difference. Like, I think in here, there's, so this is what the talks about. Actually, what's interesting about that church, too, is the architect was Henry Langley, I don't know if you know that name, but he was one of the first architects that was born and trained in Canada. And he was involved in a number of major churches in Toronto. They must have just been churning, like having the same church design for so many churches. It's kind of interesting. Robertson spoke about the church in 1887. He said it was the congregation wasn't composed of wealthy people, but rather persons of moderate circumstances, mostly mechanics and laboring people. So those were the kind of people that lived in this area
of
at
course,
the time.
Yes.
Yet they contributed nearly $3,000 yearly for local and benevolent church purposes.
That's a lot of money. 1887?
Yeah. They had 274 members, and their Sunday school in that time had 464 children with 45 officers and teachers. And when you think of it, like some of the accounts that I read, I mean, there was really no public education, so the church kind of was it. And I mean, there was no entertainment, so like the church was the highlight.
So was it constructed in 1887? Is that when it was built?
As far as you know? No, that's when he did the account. Uh-huh. The church was built in 1872.
Whoa.
And and I have the original clippings from the newspaper. We're able to get it from the archives because they used to put it in the newspaper when things were built. And it started off, it's really confusing. It was the College Street Baptist Church. Now, most people think of the College Street Baptist Church at Palmerston in College. And what happened is they started it there, and then they grew out of it very quickly, so then they sold it. And they moved to Palmerston. So this started off as a Baptist church. This Mr. Thomas Lely, I can't find too much about him, but I gather he was maybe an up-and-coming sort of merchant type. He donated the land at $4,000, and it cost about $1,600 to build it.
In 1887,
1872, yeah.
1872, I mean.
Then this was sort of the account of the church in 1887. But this is what the church looked like in 1887. And it had sort of writing over here. And I don't know if I can flip to a picture of the church today.
Well, what I definitely want to have are copies of the church as it looked at that time and how it looks now.
I have a picture. I think my daughter put a...
Is this that,
so that yeah. That's what it looks like today, and that's what it. Well, maybe it looks a little bit different. I think it has a new verse written over here, but that's what it looked like. So it really hasn't changed very much. The only thing is the Baptist in the older churches they didn't have the center aisle, So we I guess reorganized the benches a bit, but it really hasn't
really
changed.
Worked very hard to keep the original nature of it.
I would say maybe them, and also they didn't have the money. You know, it's one of the... But they've kept it very, you know, clean and neat. I mean, at one point, and I'm not so sure who did it, when that church was originally built, it was called Rough Cast, I think. It was kind of like a stucco, because there's a picture of it on the outside, and it's a little bit hard for me to... I don't know if I have it in here.
But they changed the outer.
Someone put the brick. Somebody put brick. Maybe because the stucco was starting to.
Maybe it's not as durable for winter conditions.
Yeah. But some of the interesting things. Maybe I'll just go through this. This is just a little bit about the history of early Toronto.
Just talk about some of the things that you're skimming over because.
Okay, so what I tried to do is put the church in a context initially.
Yes.
So. I think in the 1870s, Toronto had about 56,000 people. And part of this was, you know, for the doors open, the theme was the War of 1812. So in 1812, Toronto had 700 people. By 1870, it had 56,000 people, which is a pretty significant growth. And churches were really dominant throughout the church. I mean, at one point, there was, I think, a competition to see which city should be the capital of Canada, because I think originally it was Kingston, and there was a battle between Kingston, Toronto, and Ottawa. And I know there's been sayings like, well, if you want to judge the character of a city by the number of churches, well, you know, Toronto kind of takes the cake. And when you think of it, even if you're to walk along College Street, and count the number of churches that so close to.
I can just picture it.
It's amazing.
Yeah, just starting here and walking west, I can picture five immediately.
Which really doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and this just goes from here maybe to Palmerston. Yeah.
You know, so in this case, what happened was this at the time was considered rural, you know, in the 1870s. This was pretty well the wilds of Toronto. And churches were really in pretty intense competition with each other. So the Baptists, because this was considered an emerging area of Toronto, they wanted to establish themselves here. And that's why, you know, he donated the land and they built the church. And I guess Henry Langley, I guess there weren't many architects that you could choose from. So they got the designs, you know, from him. So, I mean, this was a church in 1887. I think it's very, very interesting. I have an account here, what was published in the Toronto Telegram. But, you know, the way he experienced church in 1870 in description wouldn't be much different from what you would experience today. I mean, you know, again, the congregation was a congregation of immigrants. There's nobody there that's really, really wealthy, yet they still continue to be as generous as they possibly can. Obviously numbers are down, but at one point there were a lot of people. I mean, today the building really isn't that attractive. You know, that hasn't changed, but it's got a nice ambience inside. It's quite nice. So
you know, when I finally figured out which building you're talking about, I think it's a very nice building.
Well, from the outside, it's not like St. Jane, you know, or anything like that. But
it's modest and very thin. Yeah. And I think it's a lovely looking building.
So that's what was written over this part way back when, in 1887. And I find it interesting that even today we have something written in German above here. Like they've kept up that kind of look. There was an article that the minister's wife gave me, and it was from the Toronto Star, and I have a copy of it somewhere. So these two profs, I think from York University, did a study of churches in the area. I guess they must have grown up in the area, like me, kind of interested in, okay, I've gone here, so what's the story behind all of this? So apparently from 1889 to 1955, the home was churched to six different congregations. So again, it's a reflection of it was an Episcopal church, then a United church, and this is the one that interested me, a St. Paul's Italian United Church. I mean, when I think of Italian, I think of Catholic, not United. So that was kind of interesting. So it's gone through a lot of different congregations. So that's kind of what it looked like, I guess, once our congregation bought the church, and I guess they painted it and they put in the center aisle.
Now, all the blue that I see here, is that just the
picture? It's actually white.
Okay.
It's just, the flash. Someone gave that to me. And again, like as I mentioned, it was named in honor of St. George's, the Martyr Anglican Church on John Street, which hosted the congregation. It was the second home for many German immigrants who came to Canada after World War II, and it established the first German language school in Canada. What's interesting, our minister still goes, is there is a German school in Toronto, not just like a weekend thing, a full-time German school, I guess for people who are transferred to Toronto from Germany, that kind of thing. And I think she still goes and does a blessing there once a year or something like that. And then it was a cultural hub. It had its own theater group, choir, that kind of thing.
So it was a very vital community with a lot of activities.
Yeah, and I have some things here that even demonstrate that more. So that was the church, I guess, what it looked like when they first got it. So you can see it was kind of dingy.
Yeah.
And they painted it in that. So it's kind of interesting, the church bell from Germany. There's stained glass windows in the interior of the church. I believe it was, a lot of them were made by, like, you know, craftsmen that came over from Germany. And we actually have a painting by a German prisoner of war in Canada. And the story behind that is kind of interesting, because a lot of people didn't realize there were German prisoners of war in Canada. Many of them were sent to Northern Ontario to clear lands for provincial parks. And there was one guy who was quite a talented painter. And I can't remember the area that it's in now. And I guess he was a pretty clever guy, too, because he would offer to do portraits of the mayor of the town and the camp commander and all of that. And they were impressed by her artistic ability, so I guess the head of the camp would even gave him a place to do his work and even sent down to Toronto for art supplies for this guy. And I guess, you know, after the war ended, they went back to Germany. Everyone forgot about all of this stuff. And at some point, they decided to tear down the barracks that were there. And they came across this painting. And I don't know how, but they contacted the minister of the church at that time and said, we don't know what to do with this. Like, do you want it? So he took it. And his daughter was actually like a tour guide, and she would conduct tours of Germans visiting Toronto. So in one of her tours, you know, they have the opening cocktail reception. She just went around talking to people on tour. You know, what are you hoping to get out of this tour? What would you like to see? And this guy said, well, I would like to go to this park if it's possible. And I think it was near Thunder Bay, so it was not so possible. And she said, like, well, why would you want to go there? And he said, well, I was here as a German prisoner of war, and I was an artist, and all of this stuff. And he says, I wonder if any of my artwork survived. And she said, like, say no more. Like, I know exactly where your painting is. And I thought it's pretty incredible.
Oh my God.
And he did finish it, I guess, because the war ended and he didn't have time. And so they asked him, you know, if you had to paint, would you like to finish it? And he said, no, because at that time he was very young. He was very, very angry. And he would approach it differently, you know, with the benefit of age. But it was kind of, it's an interesting story about life sometimes.
It's an absolutely remarkable, what a coincidence.
Yeah.
That she would know about the painting?
Well, that he would be in her group. I think he was in his 60s when he came back. So this is many, many, many years later. So.
And where is that painting now?
It's in the basement of the church. We brought it up for Doors Open. So.
Did anyone take a picture?
Yeah, I mean, I have some stuff that I. There's even, I don't know what I've got here. I've got a whole binder full of stuff. Mm-hmm. You can rifle through it, and I can give you what you want. That's where, this picture is kind of cool. If I could get you the original of that, which I think my son has. But that's when they sort of got the bell from Germany and they erected the steeple.
And do you know the date, approximately?
It's written here, June 1959, yeah. I think. And you have pictures of them sort of cleaning up the church. So in terms of what I've got in here, I'll just try and flip through this. This is not particularly well organized. All of the stuff that I... Yeah, so these are the, there's, you know, the stained glasses in the inside of the church. Those were added later.
When would that have been?
I'd have to ask the minister because she would probably know. What's interesting here is, I don't know if you've seen, if we went to the archives, so that's how this area looked back in 1884. So probably your house is here somewhere.
Oh, and look at the small area where there are homes and the rest is all empty.
Yeah.
That's a very long time ago, 18.
So
yeah, my house would be there because my house was 1881 on Borden Street.
Yeah, there's Borden right here. So you would be up here somewhere?
Well, so
there's a.
So I would be right here. You and I are right around here at this moment.
So I think we got that from, the Toronto Archives. You can have that if you want it because I really have no use for it.
This is lovely. I'll keep it. I'm keeping it only because I don't return anything.
No, that's fine.
Pictures.
Fine. This was probably Yeah, what I found interesting too, and these are too small, but the announcements from the newspapers, because there's the Daily Globe, and then there was the Mail, and my daughter got this from the game, the archives. I may have a better, I have some better things inside the church, actually, that my son did. I should ask him for the artwork that he did. He's an artist, so they do things for me sometimes. So he was able to put stuff on, like a foam core for me.
Do you have any idea how many families belong to the church now? Like 50 families?
I would say it might be more than that. Like, there's a lot of people who don't come.
And on a regular service versus a Christmas time, how many people would be there on a Sunday, and how many people would go during the major holidays?
I have stats on the average services. So I think for the English one, it's usually about 20 people. Uh-huh. For the German, probably around 50. But it was interesting on Christmas Eve. We had two services. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where all these people came from. We ran out of programs. It was just, it was like a zoo. And I think maybe because, was Christmas here on a Friday or Saturday or something? A lot of people came in, like even from Barrie. And it was pretty amazing.
And actually, and are these people members, or might they be people who aren't members, but they have such memories?
I suspect there was a lot of that going on as well. You know, for me as a child, it looks the same. It's a very nice memory, because typically you would go to church on Christmas Eve, but not like the Catholics where they go at midnight. You would go around 4 or 5 o'clock, you would come home, have dinner, and you would be opening gifts already around 7. And that's pretty typical for Lutherans. Like my best friend, the one from John 3, they're Finnish. Mm-hmm. And they have the same kind of tradition.
So, I guess it's a way of people hanging on to their traditions and not feeling so isolated. They come to your church and you're doing it at 4 in the afternoon and then having dinner, opening.
Well, I think, you know, when it comes to traditions like that, people stick to those. You know, it's one constant in a real changing world. Even when we did the doors open, you know, we had a few people that sort of said, like, oh my God, like, I didn't go to this church, but I went to one like it. And it brings back, you know, such nice memories, you know, when they were a child and things like that. So, yeah, so this was, my daughter blew this up. So, just figure out. We've got the year, but that's an extract from, I guess it would have been, there was the Globe and then there was the Mail before they merged. So this may have been the Daily Mail. So it talks about the church, the size of it being erected at Lippincott, being Gothic. The cost was, that's how we got the stats. The cost was $1,600. The architect was Mr. Henry Langley and the contractor was Mr. Yabis, and my daughter's got the name somewhere. But I think it's fascinating that even today, I mean, this was St. Patrick's Ward, this area, right, that you can get so much history from these old, it's all on microfiche.
It's lovely that you have it. I'd like to make some copies or have some copies of
sure.
this.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I can even leave this with you to go through or see what my daughter's at Trent right now, so it's a little more difficult for me to get stuff. But this was that one article that was so cool. And these are New York University professors of group, and they did a study on how churches change as new immigrants.
How churches
change as new immigrants arrive.
And what's the point that they make?
Well, you know, like even the church that we had went through like so many different denominations, which sort of reflected the people that lived in the area at the time.
Mm-hmm. So the different waves of immigration,
impacts.
That's who filled the church.
I mean, it's kind of like Kensington Market, right? I mean, did you grow up in this area? Or
I grew up in Montreal.
Okay, yeah. Because
in a similar kind of area.
You know, because when I grew up, I mean, and it's not intended to be derogatory, but it was known as the Jewish Market.
Yes.
And everybody did their shopping there. And then it changed, I think, to like Portuguese, and you know, different waves of immigrants coming through. It just reflects society at that time.
So the church too changed depending on
it has to,
what
you
the
know?
Major populations were at that time.
Yeah. So. So these are the professors, Roberto Perrin and Gabe Scardellato. So the two longtime friends and university professors who live in the West. So they spent many, they did a study of the area. They considered this their neighborhood, so they were intrigued by the diversity of their neighborhood. You know, home to Portuguese, Italians, Chinese, Ukrainians, Maltese, Caribbean people, Africans, and others. And so they did a study of that. One's like a professor of history at York University.
And they studied what we now call Harbord Village.
Probably I think
a slightly larger
area.
Yeah, I'm sure it was larger. Yeah.
But clearly they grew up in it, and there was a certain affection for the area. And, you know, trying to understand what happened. I know when I went to university, social history really wasn't studied as a specialty. I think it's a relatively new phenomenon, but it's something that really fascinates, you know, me. You know, what people have come and what they've endured and what they've made of it. And
I think it's a much more interesting way of studying history. When I studied it, we learned dates, and now we're talking about populations and how people lived, and mm-hmm. much more human and much more fascinating.
Yeah. So this is actually from your Harbord Village area study, right? That's where I got some information.
And who wrote that?
I have.
Doesn't say.
No idea.
And Well, I'll look at that when we turn this machine off.
Where it was. So this is like let's see what else is here. So this would have been these are church bulletins that I got. So this would have been all in German, and I tried to because it was typed. I tried to get a program to translate it into English, but it really didn't work very well. There's something here that has a history of a church being written by Germans. There's a lot of stuff in here that I wouldn't have documented, like 1959, a new heating system was installed. You know, it's a little bit over the top, but...
Okay, so from all this reading that you have done, are there some topics that I have not asked about and we haven't talked about? You've done a lot of reading because you like the church, and then when we were going to be meeting with each other. So are there any aspects that we haven't come close to yet that would be interesting for us to know as we're gathering information about this neighborhood?
I think we've covered off, you know, pretty well, you know, everything. I think, you know, maybe the concerns for the future. You know, it's been an integral part of the community for so many years. And on the one hand, you know, it's prime location in Toronto. It's a great location. But on the other hand, you know, there's a different demographic in the area now. And so what implications that has for the future.
And how much people are willing to travel. I mean, you and your daughter do a long trip about
twice
for
me, a month. I drive. I mean, it's not a big deal. On a Sunday morning, I'm down in 25 minutes. But there's a lot of people who are elderly and just, you know, a lot of them are coming with Wheel-Trans. It's a big ordeal for them to come.
Yeah. So it's an aging population, aside from some of the young people who might come, like this young German man. Yeah.
So that's probably, but that's a challenge that, you know, many churches in the area, you know, face, including you go into St. Stephen's, wrong side of College Street, but it's in quite a state of disrepair, and there's no money to fix it. And yet, you know, I know in Quebec, I mean, they have, you know, very much the same situation. And actually the business I'm in reinsurance, so we insure insurance companies.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And so I have some clients in Quebec, and one of them is actually, all they do is insure churches. And so they have the same problem. You know, you've got a lot of churches in downtown Montreal. People aren't going anymore. It's expensive to keep them. what do you do with them? And I think to a certain extent, the Quebec government is stepping in a little bit more and saying, okay, this is part of our cultural heritage, and trying to help people at least restore their buildings. But, you know, with budgets being what they are. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And taxes being what they are, and people not wanting to pay more.
Well, exactly. You know, it's not that people aren't generous or anything like that. The money is not there. So it will be interesting to see how that church kind of evolves going forward. So, I mean, that's all I can really, you know, say. And I don't know if there's any really good pictures in here. Some of these, there are, what do you think? There's one that was kind of interesting. So let's see. So these are like the first church councils. I think that was the first school day for the German school. There's pictures of confirmations in here. I mean,
I just want to ask one question. You said that on an average Sunday, the German service has about 50 people, and the English service has about 20 people. Is there a big age difference? What I'm wondering is, the 20 are those younger people, and the 50 are those older people?
Typically, or you might get people like myself who have maybe gotten away and coming back, so maybe we're sort of the middle ground. Mm-hmm. We also actually, you asked about demographics, so there are a lot of people too of German heritage who don't speak, you know, German anymore. Like, my parents spoke German at home, but I answered in English. There's the whole generation like that. And then we also, because of the connection with Kostelec, we do have some people from Africa. So it's a really eclectic kind of mix, but there is kind of that division. Or you may have, in some cases, younger people who will go with their German parent to the German mm-hmm. service, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But this would have been, I don't know when this would have been, 1984. I mean, these were all the church members. So that gives you
1984. So it has really,
give you
the numbers have declined drastically.
Yeah, well, many, it's they've died, right?
Yeah. So, well, I think maybe we will bring the formal part of our discussion to an end, and I'll look at some of these articles and pictures with you, and then we'll decide what I might make copies of.
Or what I can do is I'll try to the best of my abilities to get my kids' time, and I know my son had a number of pictures. I'm not sure whose computer they're on. So whether they're on his, maybe they're even on my home computer, or whether my daughter has them, and I could flip those to you, because I suspect that you probably would have a pretty good selection there.
I'd certainly appreciate that. But I just find it wonderful when I listen to you talk about your daughter. Your mother was so much a large part of her life because you worked and your mother was raising your children. And she likes to be in the church. She feels her grandmother's presence.
Yeah. Even for me. I mean, you know, I think my mother would have died of shock if she saw that I was involved with the church. But it's a bit of a connection, to the past.
Yeah. Well, Chris, I just want to say thank you very much. It's extremely interesting, and you and I will continue to talk for a few minutes, and I'll look at the information that you have and the pictures that you have. But you wondered when I asked you,
I was a bit nervous because I didn't actually grow up. I obviously spent time in this area.
Yeah, but the church is, it's still there, and it has been there for a very long time.
Yeah.
So we do, all of us, really appreciate your contribution, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.